Welcome back to Banter by the Bay with me, DJ Bus Stop. We will be here today visited by the nice man, Temple. You know, he's in the Temple of Swan. Okay, comes right after here. We will banter around about Warriors basketball. We'll talk about a couple scenarios. I kind of threw out a scenario to him earlier. Who's better, Tim Duncan or Kobe Bryant in the span of their career? We'll banter about that a little bit. We'll talk a little Niners. He's a Raiders fan, so we might have to talk a little Raiders on this episode. And then we'll finish up with some hot stove. MLB's getting a little tasty right now. About to see some big transactions. We've already seen a couple. The Giancarlo Stan, the $13,325,000 contract. We'll go discuss it because there's very interesting situations, and it's definitely backloaded, and we'll go into more detail about that. But right now we're going to go talk about the Warriors basketball because it's so fun right now. Last 10 games, we're 8-2, so we got a nice start. Curry is definitely becoming he's definitely showing what he wants to possess as an offense. He wants to become a passing offense. So far, they've had averaging 60 more passes a game. That's incredible. 60 more passes a game? That's unbelievable. It's just, you don't have a stagnant offense. You're always moving, rolling, all that. It's just, it's unbelievable how you can make this offense flow and it becomes so dynamic and devastating. You know, you have Curry out there for three, but if that ball's moving around, the defenders are moving around, and you know, it's easy to get those wide open shots, especially when you got the ball handling skills of Curry. You know, Temple's coming in right now, going to talk to us about some more Warriors basketball.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Zach.
Of course.
I know we've been trying to schedule this for a while now, but finally got to it as I got here a little bit early, ready to rock and roll, talk some dubs with you.
Yes.
And you touched on it there, 8-2. The Warriors are passing the ball extremely well early on. I didn't know the stat that they're passing it 60 more times per
60
game.
60 more times.
That doesn't even seem possible.
No.
Like, how do you pass it 60 more times in a game? But it really shows the difference between the two offenses. You know, Mark Jackson, it was pretty much all isolation, trying to get Iguodala and Bogut to really post up on an iso play. It isn't really their game.
Definitely so stagnant.
Yeah, exactly. And now you can see the difference already with Curry, Thompson, Draymond Green, everyone getting open shots due to the great passing.
I mean, you can definitely see in the Draymond Green, he just gets every three that he hits. I mean, he's definitely more of a catch and shoot. He can't create his own three, but when he gets that catch and two three, he's shooting around 60%. That's incredible.
Yeah, and you see it. All of his damage is coming from the top of the key, too. That's like his hot spot.
Uh-huh.
And they call that pretty much the bread and butter of Draymond Green, off the pick and roll, get that wide open look.
Pick and pop.
Yeah, exactly. And he's been knocking them down. Yeah. So I really like the way his game has progressed.
Uh-huh.
Like you said, he's a very good catch and shoot shooter. So we'll see if they can keep kind of getting that ball movement to get those open shots with guys like Draymond Green and guys like Iguodala.
Definitely. Iguodala needs to start taking some more shots. The last, I say, 5 or 6 games he's been taking, averaging a little bit. You know, I think 6 to 9 shots a game. Before that, it was less than that. So he's really becoming, he needs to become more of the offense, especially on the second team where we have definitely a less of a scoring mindset, more of a defensive mindset where we have, you know, Sean Livingston is definitely not an offensive guard. He's definitely a 6'7" long two guard, even point guard, can shut down their best player if he's out there. You know, there's just no scoring, and that's what Iguodala needs to bring. He's a superstar in this league. He was a superstar. He should still be, you know, looking for his shot, not just trying to dish it.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, and we saw it against the Spurs for the most part. That's when I think every Warrior fan got a little frustrated with Iguodala. He passed up on two shots that were like 2 feet from the basket with no one on him, and he threw him out to the three-point line and got turnovers off him because he was not aggressive on the offensive side. And you could see what he could do off the dribble. He gets to the paint with ease, getting by the perimeter defenders, but he just doesn't have the confidence right now to kind of go up with it and try to kind of get his own baskets, either get to the free throw line or get 2 points off it because you're pretty darn close.
No, absolutely. He doesn't have that killer instinct to attack the hoop right now. And that's what he used to have back in when these Sixers, when they had no offense.
Yeah, he was the offense.
Yeah, he was their offense. He was averaging 20 points, 18 points a game. But now he sees like, oh, I have to back off a little bit because there's so many great scorers on this team that I need to be the defensive person. No, you don't. You can play both sides. You know, we're a defensive team now. We're a defensive unit. And you see how Curry is becoming more of a defensive player. Bogut is Bogut, you know, just the rim protector. God, it, without him, I don't know how our defense would be. You know, with David Lee out, there's less of a defensive worry because Draymond Green is there. But then also that takes another score away, and that could be an issue in the long run.
Yeah, and you touched on it there. I mean, Iguodala, I think even with the Nuggets, when he came over in the trade, he still was scoring the basketball and looking for a shot. But all of a sudden, kind of things changed when he came to the Warriors because he had that mindset, like you said, to just play defense. But really, you're kind of taking away a huge facet of his game, which is he has a very good dribble penetration and he's a great passer. Yeah. So when Iguodala is only focusing on defense, you're kind of missing an element to his game that you traded for from getting him for the Nuggets.
And you just lose a whole player on offense. And you have Sean Livingston, who's not a great offensive player either. And then you got Barbosa, who's strictly offense. But again, it's, you know, you can't rely on one player. And probably Draymond Green would be filling in that position, and he's not an offensive threat, especially when the big three are not out there, Curry, Thompson, and Bogut, because, you know, they work the offense through them, and Draymond gets the benefits of them getting double teamed or definitely looked more at. So there's no second scoring. I mean, and then you got the center would be Festus. You know, that's Mo Spates. You know, Mo Spates is looking good. He's definitely been practicing with the second team now, but how long can Mo Spates really last? You know, he's never proven himself as a scoring low post for the duration of a year, especially on this high power team and this up and down where, you know, he was huffing and puffing. There was at the end of the second quarter at halftime, you know, when he was playing some big minutes. But, you know, he is kind of a fit right now, but in the future, Iguodala has to be scoring that second unit because without him, we're really just so behind, and he needs to set up and facilitate. You know, he's kind of letting that not be part of his game.
Yeah, and one guy who I think has stepped up in the absence of Iguodala has been Harrison Barnes. Over the last three games, scoring double digits, getting to the rack, and actually going to the free throw line because of aggressiveness. And I think that's, I don't know if that's a bode to his confidence because he's in the starting lineup now with Kerr, but he's kind of switched roles with Iguodala and what I expected. Because Harrison Barnes had a bad year last year. Kind of we expected him to take off after that playoff series 2 years ago and kind of had a downward spiral last year, and we kind of expected a lot more from him. And now this year you can kind of see what kind of player he is.
He was such a stud his rookie year, and then he had that down. We're all like, oh, you know, there's always that sophomore slump in any sport because you're so good and then you think you can just do it again without much work. But that's not true. Everyone's always adapting in all these professional sports. People are adapting to you, learning you better, knowing how to defend you better. So I think he's got that feeling now, like, okay, they have confidence in me. I should be able to do it. I'm going to have great opportunities with mismatches because I have such great teammates around me. I have such great passing. I think he's become more of, you know, all right, the system works for me, and this will enable me to bring it to the hole. You know, he doesn't have to sit there and hit those threes, which he's doing great so far.
Yeah.
He's definitely shooting way better than what I expected, but he's driving, and that's what we know. He's a high flyer. Just drive. Take the ball to the hole.
Yeah, and you're seeing that as a whole with the Warriors' offense. They're getting to the paint a lot more frequently than they used to. They're not really relying on the three ball. Even though they got it in the back pocket and they know they can knock it down, there really is a focus to get the ball inside and kind of get higher quality shots closer to the rack. And I think that's a great improvement that already through 10 games I've seen.
Absolutely. And you see that with Bogut too. It was three straight games with a double-double. He only had, like, what, I think it was 10 double-doubles all of last year.
Yeah, and Bogut used to never get the opportunity to shoot.
Yeah, it was always offensive rebounds.
Yeah.
But now he's gotten, he's not getting plays called from him, but he's getting the ball down low, and he's making that move to left, and he's confident with those shots. But the key factor about him bringing it to the hole and being confident on his offense is him hitting free throws. If he thinks and can make free throws, then he will have all the confidence in his offense because then he won't mind getting fouled.
Yeah, and he'll attack the rim.
Yes, exactly. And that's what they were to Jim Barnett and Bob Fitzpatrick was talking about that. And it was great. You know, he needs to be just, you know, confident with himself and confident with his free throw shooting, and then he can be such a force, and once that happens, they can't.
Yeah, exactly. Like he was with Milwaukee, because forget that he was a great scorer and probably one of the top two centers in the league at the time.
He was defensive player of the year.
Yeah,
he
exactly.
Was just everything.
And he had the offensive threat to go along with it too. And we really hadn't seen a center like that in quite some time. So I know that the Warriors, when they traded for him, didn't really expect an offensive side from him. But if the development kind of continues and he could stay on the court and play good minutes for Steve Kerr, then I think.
Yeah,
he can only grow as much.
And he could play in the fourth quarter now.
Exactly.
That's what you don't want to have to take him out in the fourth quarter when it counts, when the game's on the line because of free throws. You want him to be there to protect the rim at that time. I mean, and that's so important. And that's what I think we've missed the last couple of years, because it's such was such a stagnant offense where he would just sit at the top of the key and just be a facilitator. He would just pass the ball, which he did a lot last year, but he never had the opportunity to take the ball to the hole or set a pick and roll. You know, it was always, you know, pass it off to the best matchup and watch them go. Just get on the other side of the court and offense or rebound.
Yeah.
So it's a different aspect. I wanted to ask you a question. I heard this yesterday on the radio. Out of the three players, who's the most important to the Warriors right now, Bogut, Curry, or Thompson?
See, that could be a tough question, I think, because they're all so vitally important. I think we need each of them to be in the Warriors line for them to be successful. But if you had to choose one player, I think I know what you're going to choose because we talked about this earlier, but I would say Stephen Curry just because he's the de facto point guard and he's kind of the main ticket right now for the Warriors. But I know that they can handle life without him due to their backup point guards in Barbosa and in Livingston, so I know that they can kind of handle that. But just the way that Curry's kind of progressed into an all-star and kind of in the face of the NBA now with all the highlights he's making, and he's kind of just become one of the top three point guards in the league.
I
think it'd be tough if the Warriors lost Curry for an extended amount of time just for that reason. What's your opinion on that?
I think my opinion is with Bogut because he's the defensive stopper. He's, you know, he's facilitating. He's got his assists are up. You know, the only probably only big man that is comparable that I think to him right now is Marcus Gasol. I really don't think there's anyone at the five position who's a true center anywhere near where Bogut's. And I think just having a true center is just truly a true aggressive mean center. I mean, Dwight Howard's not mean. Dwight Howard doesn't get in there and, you know,
he pretends to be mean.
He pretends to be mean with Kobe.
Yeah.
And he just throws an elbow at him for no reason. Come on. And he but Bogut's mean. You know, against the Clippers, he's mean. He's coming at you. He's talking trash.
Yeah, he's the one initiating all the brawls.
Oh yeah, he is, without a doubt.
And I think that's his Aussiness.
I love it.
But then I like that answer because if you take Bogut out of the equation, then you look at the backup centers.
Festus.
You got Festus and Spates, who I don't think, I mean, the drop off between Festus and Spates at the backup is way more significant than the drop off of either Barbosa, Iguodala, Barnes, or Livingston taking over at the point guard.
So many different places. We have so many guards at our disposal.
Yeah, so I mean, that question could go either way. I think Clay, the way he's evolved, he could still be in that discussion, but I would rank him third behind Bogut and Curry.
Because I think you can put, if he goes down, you put Iggy Phil is in right there in the two guard.
Yeah.
Or Harrison goes to the two guard and Iggy goes to three. I mean, those are just interchangeable parts.
Exactly. So, I mean, that's a good question, though. I mean, each of them, though, are going to be integral parts to the Warriors' success this season, and they need to make sure that they're playing, I want to say, 70-plus games for all of them. They've got to stay on the court healthy and make sure they're there for the postseason stretch.
It looks good so far. I think out of their 10 games, all those three, I think out of four of them, they've played less than 30 minutes.
Yeah, I was reading that stat, and you look at the Cavaliers, on the other hand, where they have Love, Irving, and LeBron in the top five.
Yeah, playing 35-plus minutes.
Yeah, so their three best players are going to – I mean, I feel like they're going to feel that down the stretch when it comes to the postseason.
Oh, absolutely.
All these minutes are logging. And that's a good thing that Kerr's done with this Warriors roster. And, I mean, granted, they've had a lot of blowout wins, so they've gotten to rest late in some of these games. But still, limiting the minutes of your key cogs is kind of going to help you down the stretch and keep your legs fresh for that postseason run.
I mean, we talked about this earlier. The next seven games, we got some real favorable matchups.
Yeah, they go to that East Coast road trip. Yeah, East Coast road trip.
We
that's
play
favorable
Miami.
To everyone.
I think our hardest matchup is Miami at Miami.
You got the Hornets, you got the Magic, you got the Pistons. I mean, all winnable games. So hopefully you can continue this trend to where you're getting out to leads early and you're kind of just playing good defense, and then you can kind of coast in the fourth quarter. You can read as a schedule. I think you just brought it up.
Yes,
right
I just
there.
Picked up the schedule. We play at Jazz at home on Friday, Thunder on Sunday, Heat, Magic, Hornets, Pistons. Go to December. Magic, Pelicans, Bulls, Timberwolves, and Rockets. I mean, that stretch right there, I think we could possibly lose three games. That's out of another 12 games there.
Yeah, and that's all what the Warriors should be doing. Yes. And I think they really haven't had a letdown to this point like we saw last year.
The way that
the Warriors are coming out and beating teams that they should be beating is really something special in comparison to last year. Because you'd have home games last year against the Hornets or against teams like that where you just drop it.
Toronto, we're down 27 or something.
Yeah, and you'd have
crazy.
To make some miraculous comeback. And that's at home against teams that you should be dominating in the Eastern Conference. So I think that's only 10 games in, might mind it, but I mean, the way that the Warriors have kind of played against lesser opponents has been something also to watch.
I mean, 10 games is a small sample size, but still, it's 1/8 of the season.
That's
come
true.
On, it's you are getting there. You're getting a third of the fourth of the way to the All-Star break. I mean, you have to win these games. I mean, you look at OKC right now, they're 3-9. they're going to have a hard time making up those games because the West is so difficult.
Yeah.
The top teams are not going to lose that many games. They're going to lose 10 games,
and
9
games.
You have
teams like the Kings already who are playing extremely well, and the Thunder are trailing them by 5 games now.
I know, and Kings can be anyone.
Exactly.
They can be anyone, but they can lose to anyone too.
And that's probably the number 13 or 14 team in the Western Conference coming into the season. So the West is so deep in comparison, and like you said, the Thunder, not due to their own fault, but the fault of their own. I mean, they got injuries, and they're kind of digging themselves in a hole right now.
I mean, these games
count.
These games count, and you know they're in the game till halftime, third quarter, end of third quarter. They just run out of steam. Their bench is just not deep enough, and they just don't have those closers. I mean, that's what you have to have in the NBA, and that's what the Warriors have. They have closers. They have people that can come in if there's a run coming on our second team. If they're going on a run, we have people that can stop the run and slow down the offense and slow down the defense and really hold them. And I think this is the difference between us this year and last year. I think we have more confidence as a team.
Much more depth, too.
Just as a depth. Anyone can fill in for anyone at any time, you know. Draymond's not having a good game. Okay, here you go, Mo.
Yeah.
Have some go at it, you know.
I think 1-10, really, because Kerr's been playing like 10 men solidly per game. Just way deeper than the Warriors have been in the past.
And Brandon Rush hasn't even played much.
Yeah, exactly. And he's still working his way back from injury. So you think if you just keep... The guys that we haven't even been playing really could be second stringers on most teams. So, I mean, Warriors have built this team this year to make a run. They've gotten the favorable now with Thunder being down, kind of with injuries. The Rockets hit or miss with them.
Definitely hit
so,
or
I
miss.
Mean, the West is open. If you can take down the Spurs and the Grizzlies, who look to be the two top contenders, the Warriors have a chance this year to do it all.
I agree. I think this is the most exciting, you know, being a Warriors fan my whole life and seeing this team from absolutely nothing come to, whoa. We can actually do this. We have a chance. We don't have to think about what if. We don't have to think about it. Let's just get into the playoffs with that 8 seed, hopefully. Let's do something. And it's a very exciting time for Warriors fans, and I think you all should appreciate it. Watch every game and really show your support. This is going to be a fantastic year. I think Kerr has brought a new attitude. I don't think he's been satisfied with the win. I think, you know, he comes in, you know, and he sees a win. We win by 20, but he sees a ton of mistakes. He sees 27 turnovers or 25 turnovers, and he says that's just will not cut it.
Yeah, he knows what it takes to be a championship team, and that's why he really is breeding excellence even when they do win by 20. If you give up 20-plus turnovers as a team, that's not going to get the job done in the playoffs.
Yeah.
And he's kind of teaching these guys from the get-go, from the first game on, saying that we need to expect excellence and really play with excellence.
Because
nothing short is acceptable.
I agree. I think that Spurs game really slapped us in the face and said, you know what? You turn the ball over like that, it's going to...
We're not there yet.
Yeah. We're trying to become the Spurs. That's really who we're trying to become. And we have the foundation. We have those three. The Mono is like the Clay, and the Parker is Curry, and Duncan is, you know, Bogut. And it's just... There's a similarity, and then there's a role players that are so similar in aspects defensively, and we can be them, and we can be better in aspects of games like 3-point shooting. Definitely, you know, it's gonna be so fun. But they have to buy into this, which I think they are. I think we have to keep on passing, keep on moving. Let's get fast break. Alvin Gentry was on KMBR yesterday, which is different because Mark Jackson never let any of his
Mark Jackson had some problems with his assistant
coaches.
Yeah,
they never let any of his assistant coaches go on any talk shows or talk about anything. They were zipped. And that's why Brian Scalabrine really had a problem, because he came out to talk to the radio, and Mark Jackson scolded him and said, like, don't do that. And that was what their big argument was about. And that just doesn't make sense. I think there has to be some kind of an ego issue. You know, is it all about Mark Jackson? Why can't his – I mean, he had some – old head coaches on his team, former head coaches. Like, come on. These guys know basketball. They know the media. They're putting in the same work that Jackson's putting in, probably more.
Yeah, exactly. These assistant scouting coaches. and all that. So that's kind of a shot to his ego, like you said, to more than anything, which is kind of unacceptable.
Absolutely. And you see how Alvin Gentry, he had a great spot down in L.A. with the Clippers. You know, they could have won a champion. He was with Doc. And he comes because he thought we had so much talent, and he's close with Kerr, you know, and that's just such a helpful – he's such an offensive-minded coach, and I love it. And we have Tom Ford, I think that's his name, as our defensive specialist, and he's just turned these players into something. You know, Curry was like, give me that challenge. I want to be challenged. Superstars want to be challenged. It's like when Michael took a whole summer, it was like, I will not touch a basketball. I will practice my defense.
Yeah.
It's just,
and that's why he was an elite defender, which is kind of not never talked about.
Never
with Jordan.
Talked about.
He always was guarding the best player of the other team.
Yeah, him and Scottie.
Yeah, exactly.
Shut down defenders.
And that's why they were championship teams, because they played defense and their superstars bought into playing defensive ball.
It's awesome. It's great.
Something that's never talked about. I'm glad you mentioned that.
Yes. It is amazing how defense is definitely looked down upon in NBA, because you have to have a superstar to win a title. I mean, I think out of all 30 teams, there's only been, I think, 11 champions, 11 different champions. Me and my friend were talking about this the other day. It's like the Pistons have won a couple, of course, the Lakers, the Celtics. I think the Knicks got a couple. The Spurs have a majority, and then there's a drop off after that. The other Sixers have like one, you know, the Portland Trail Blazers have one. It's a very
spread out,
very spread out,
teams,
but not many.
Yeah, exactly.
It's because those teams have had superstars, and that's what has won championships. Yeah. You don't win in the NBA without it's not baseball, it's not football, where football is so defensive minded.
Yeah, exactly.
You know. There's no superstar on the Seattle team. There is no superstar. Marshawn Lynch is their most closest thing.
Yeah.
Richard Sherman
became a superstar because of his talk.
Yes.
But you see this year, he's getting kind of burned.
Yeah.
Hasn't been that elite cornerback.
Cornerbacks are come and go.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, Revis is back.
Because,
of course, anybody who comes back to the Patriots is back.
Of course, whoever they pick up, right?
It's just terrifying.
But I agree. It's really, you need a superstar in the NBA to win. And you actually need multiple, which is what we've seen with the Spurs, what we saw with the Heat with Bosh, Wade, and LeBron. You need those big name players. And you need multiple of them to win championships.
I agree. And I think we have them in the rising.
I think so, too.
And I think we're very lucky right now, because we're paying Curry a nice four-year, $44 million
contract. And at the time, that seemed like a risk, too, because due to his injury.
Ankle issues.
They're like, why would you give Curry that kind of money? Yeah. He hasn't really proved it
yet. Him and Ty Lawson got the exact same deal at the exact same time. And that was it was comparing them. And then, boom, we beat them in the playoffs. Ty Lawson just sinks, and you see Curry becoming this, you know, shooting
legend.
Star.
He's becoming a legend.
He is just pure.
And he's still extremely young, too, so he's going to get the max coming up soon. Warriors going to have to ante up on that one as well.
Yeah, that's fine. That's only $6 million a year.
Exactly. They got a nice bargain on him, and I'm glad that they did it early, too.
Yes, they did it real early.
It worked out for them.
Yeah, because it was funny, because they were comparing Curry's contract to Bumgarner's contract, who got paid $750,000 this year.
And gets paid, I didn't even know that.
And gets paid next year 3.75, and then the year after that 6.75, and the year after that 9.75, and then the year after that 12, and then option for the Giants to pick him up for another 12, and that's only if he gets 200 innings pitched. And then another option, he has two back-to-back options, the club options, where they can bring him back and and for $12 million, if he pitches 200 innings.
And that's the World Series MVP right
that's
there.
That's the World Series MVP, and that's also a 24-year-old.
Yeah.
And that's another 5 years ahead. But I promise you, they won't get to that next five.
Yeah, they're going to do it early.
They'll extend him, and they'll give him that whatever.
Yeah.
They'll give him that 20 in a couple years, and then...
Because he deserves it.
Yeah, but
it's going to come later.
Yeah.
Exactly.
No, but that 20 will come, but that will be... Everyone will be like, oh, that's a big deal. But then when his contract would be up as a free agent, you'll see starting pitchers get 28, 30 million.
Yeah, because starting pitchers are already trending up to 15 million per year.
Yeah.
And that's guys for like Scott Kazmir last year got 11 million.
Yeah, that's crazy.
And that's a guy who just came back.
How to come 18?
Yeah, from indie ball.
Jeez.
It's like these guys, if you're a decent three or four starting pitcher, you're going to hit the bank in the
free
agent market. 10
plus mil.
Because pitching is so coveted in the free agent market.
I know.
It's crazy.
I know. We're going to go to break right now, and then when we come back, we'll talk a little hot stove. More baseball.
News to get your mind off your day. Let's get it started. Carnell Alexander at one point owed $60,000 in child support for a child he did not father and knew nothing about. But despite successfully challenging the claim 20 years ago, he still owes about $30,000. The mother who accused him long ago admitted saying that naming a quote-unquote father was necessary to get welfare benefits. A judge thus wiped out Alexander's debt to her, but the state of Michigan still demands that Alexander repay benefits it had paid to the mother. In October, Andrew Davies was ordered by a high court in England not to lie down in public places anymore, unless genuinely stricken by emergency. Previously, he had had a habit of making bogus calls to 911 to get attention. When police confiscated his phone, he began compensating by lying in roads until compassionate passersby called for an ambulance. A Polish doctor says she has been in deep shock since learning that a 91-year-old woman she pronounced dead woke up in the morgue several hours later. The doctor said she was sure the patient was dead after finding, quote, no basic life functions during a morning house call on November 6th. Shortly before midnight, an undertaker who brought in another body noticed the patient was moving inside a bag she had been placed in. Once it was opened, the patient complained of being cold and asked for hot tea, the media said. She was then taken home. More than 6 million students have downloaded the new iPhone app, PhotoMath, to solve Algebra 1 and Algebra 2 problems. Students do this by pointing the camera's phone at a printed equation. The answer and the explanation quickly appear on the screen as a teaching tool, or if students, quote, want to show their work. The Croatia-based developer told the Quartz website in October that it is working on upgrades for higher-level math equations, but no relief is in sight for those chronically pesky word problems. Neighbors in the Mandarin neighborhood of Jacksonville, Florida, complained to the city recently about a resident who scattered hundreds of mothballs around her front yard, even driving over them in her car to crush them open and extend their obnoxious odor. The National Pesticide Information Center warned that the mothballs were hazardous to plants, wildlife, water, and air. But the female resident said she was forced into the tactic in order to prevent neighborhood dogs from defecating in her yard. I'm Harley D. signing off. This is radio.dominican.edu.
And welcome back. Thanks for listening and holding on. And we're going to go on to hot stove baseball now. We're going to talk about rumors going around, some talks, some signings that just happened. Of course, we got to start off with Giancarlo Stanton's big, big contract. 13 years, $325 million. What do you think about that, Mike?
Yeah, we were talking about this earlier, and on the surface, it seems like a lot of money to give one player because, of course, record-setting for 13 years. I mean, he's got just a long deal and pretty much heavy in money, but then you're the one who brought it up to me that it's really backloaded. And for a guy like Giancarlo Stanton, who's the face of your franchise, one of the top three outfielders in the game, it's nice to have him locked up for a long period of time and knowing that he'll be wearing that orange for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, it has to be for a long time. I mean, it's backloaded in this way. It's the first 6 years he can make $108 million. It's $10 million first 3 years, and then it goes up exponentially. It goes from 14, 18, 22. So he can make $108 million, and then he can make the rest $218 after the sixth year. And what happens in the sixth year, he can opt out of his contract, which means he can opt out and become a free agent, which would be a very interesting situation for him because, you know, if they're not good and they're not putting a pieces around him, I think he was going to opt out. He's going to leave $218 million on the table, but I think at that time his price might be higher because he's still only 25 years old.
Yeah, and that's the main bargaining chip he had, really, was his youth and how well he's played over the last couple of years. And then you look at his home run, like the amount of distance that he accumulates in his home runs. I mean, he's got unbelievable pop.
He's a freak.
I mean, it's just really, like you said, it's freak-like.
Yeah.
The how far he can hit it and how often he hits home runs. And then his defense is underrated. We talked about the Warriors, how their defense is underrated. Giancarlo Stanton's defense in the outfield, very underrated. He has a powerful arm.
Great arm.
And he's got very good range for his size. So, I mean, Giancarlo's a good all-around five-tool kind of athlete. Yeah. So, I mean, the Marlins got a nice little deal there with having Giancarlo sign long-term.
Yeah, I agree. I really do think they did a great job. And I heard an interview. He was interviewed about this, of course, after this big deal. He had to come out and do an interview. But this was an on-field interview, and he's like, I saw the young talent around. I wanted to be part of this. You know, as me viewing this, I was like, oh, he's just going to blab, whatever about, you know, he's got to say it's about the team and he's got his huge contract. But he said, you know, he was straightforward. He's like, if it's not working out after these first 6 years, I have a contract. I can get out of this, you know.
Yeah, flexibility.
He wants to win, and that's what's going to make him so good. You know, when you get money, a lot of the players want to be cush and they want to go eat and they want to go do things that they've never been able to do their whole life. really extravagant things. I mean, that was Pablo's first issue when he came up to the league and got his first, you know, was starting to make his first millions. He thought, oh my God, I got all this money. You know, I can start living the life that I've seen on TV. I could eat, I could do whatever. And he gained the weight. And that's what happened in 2010. He really was just so bad. And we had to bench him.
Yeah, and I think the Marlins have the potential to be something extremely talented-wise on the roster standpoint in these upcoming years. You saw the young talent they had this year. They're predicted to be last in the NL, and what do? They come out and compete for three-fourths of the season
absolutely.
With great young pitching, and they lost Fernandez to this surgery, and they still were able to hang tough and kind of battle in that National League. So, I mean, I expect a lot from the Marlins now with locking up Stanton and kind of going towards the role of competitor now.
Yeah, absolutely.
They're kind of dedicated towards that, so...
Yeah, I think it really all depends on the owner because this guy he fire-sailed. He got rid of Jose Reyes. He got rid of everyone, you know. And Giancarlo Stanton was one of those people that came out and said, no, I want to win. Do not do this to me. I need people, and we need people behind us to become a franchise. And what also I heard was that now this $325 million deal becomes such an interesting chip for when he wants to sell the team, because supposedly he wants to sell the team soon, and now he has $325 million invested into one player, and that's the $325 million that a new owner would have to put his money into because he has to be paying that now. And it's interesting because it's like, whoa, wow, this means that you're going to be long term now. This means if they suck in 6 years and you're losing money, you can't get out of this because you still owe this guy $218 million, and you pray he opts out.
And they just built that new ballpark, spent a lot of money in the renovation of that. So really, he's spending a lot of money, but now it's time to see kind of the payoff in his kind of investment.
It's sad because that place is never full, empty.
Yeah, and that's the thing about Florida sports teams is they don't get the fans to come out.
Yeah, there's way more.
I mean, you saw the Heat when they were winning championships. They still wouldn't get sellouts in regular season games. It's fair weather fans down there.
Go to Jacksonville games.
Yeah, exactly. The Jacksonville Jaguars had to put in a score, like a little canopy, a cabana pool thing at their stadium just to get fans to
cut out so many seats to put that for like eight people.
Just to get fans to excited about going to a Jaguars game. I mean, you see all the things that
gimmicks,
kind of
the gimmicks. Look Florida's at the Marlins. Having, look at the Marlins. They got that shooting cannon, water cannons, and that whatever that thing is in the outfield.
What whatever that is.
Yeah, I don't even know.
It cost them, I think, $5 million to put in or whatever the outrageous
some
number
beautiful
was.
Artwork.
Yeah, exactly. But that's just to try to get fans excited about the ballpark itself and not really the team that's on the field, because right now they're struggling, all the Florida teams, at getting attendance on a consistent basis.
I think they did it wrong. I don't think you build a stadium like that. I don't think you build a very flamboyantly, you know, colored
aquarium.
Yeah, I know.
And the freaking behind the home plate,
it's
the backstop.
Look at the most recent ballparks that have been built and that have become, you know, nice, the best ballparks in the league. We got AT&T, of course, a homer. I'll put that up there. You got Oriole Stadium. We got Camden Yard. And you got PNC Park. Those are all beautiful, rustic, you know, older looking, smaller. I mean, that's what's wrong. The Marlins have a 60,000-person stadium. No one fills 60,000 a game.
They're drawing like 10,000 maybe a game.
And what it does, it makes your team look so bad because they pan around the stadium and it looks like empty. But as a Giants fan, there's only max 43,000.
Yeah.
So it's you can fill it with 30,000 and people, it looks packed.
Yeah, exactly. I agree. I couldn't agree more with that. I mean, I think there's two ways to go on this, and I think the Niners are kind of seeing that because they just built their new stadium. They tried to pack it with a large crowd kind of thing, with a lot of seats, kind of nothing to the extent of where the Marlins were doing, but you can kind of see it to where when you open it up to more fans and more seating, it's a good thing when it's full, but when it's not full or when fans go up to go see the new concourse and stuff, it looks extremely empty.
See, that's the biggest issue. I go to the Niner games. I've been to a couple this year. I'm going this weekend, and I sit on the shady side behind the Niners bench. Which is great. And I'm in the club section where I can go back into the club, and you know there's all these TVs and stuff like that. But if you go across the field behind the away section, and the sun is directly hitting them, it was like a 90-degree day up there. All those people, you know, their fans there are definitely not the most knowledgeable of football. Because, again, it's not in San Francisco. There was not a great population of football fans, diehard, that's been in that part. That part is kind of developed.
Yeah,
it's developed in 15 years,
yeah.
Whereas San Francisco has been, you know, been cultured for so long with the Niners. But these fans are not that great. They don't want to be sitting and sweating in the sun, so they go up into the concourse or they go up into the club, watch it on the TVs, and then you lose that loudness. You lose that impact on the game. That's the most important thing. We impact the game. It's so crucial. Getting offenses to call timeout, opposing offenses to call timeout. It's interesting that you see Seattle just do it so well. It's just like they're pumping in the volume, and it's – and you don't see the Niners. It's just sad.
Yeah, think about the Seattle Stadium. Since we're kind of just off topic here, we went from baseball over to Seattle. Know. But since we're on the topic, a guy that I go to the Raider games with, he sits right behind us, and he's a season ticket for the Raiders. He went to the Raider versus Seahawk game just 2 weeks ago, and he said the place really isn't that loud, but what makes it extremely tough to play in and why it kind of echoes is because of the way it's built. You know, it's built so high, and it's kind of seeing
up.
Over.
Yeah, it's
straight seeing
up.
Over the field. So he's like. And yeah, granted, the Seahawks weren't playing that great, but he said, really, it's not that loud, but it kind of just rumbles and it echoes.
Yeah.
And that's what makes it tough on opposing teams there to come in and win. But that's the way a stadium should be built.
Yeah,
it should be an advantage like
it's
that.
Such an advantage. And it's amazing because Kansas City is the second loudest crowd, which is kind of misplayed because they do not have a straight up and down building. They have an old building, older stadium that is more of a bowl shape, and it is ridiculous. It doesn't matter if they're good or bad. That is loud there, and it doesn't. And it really shows. I mean, they always go back before with Seattle on who's the loudest stadium in the world or in the U.S. or something like that. And it's Kansas City. It just has great fans. Like Seattle, I won't praise because I do not like Seattle.
Agreeably so.
Let's get back to the hot stove.
We can go to another Kansas City player coming to the Bay Area. Billy Butler.
Let's talk about Billy Butler going to the A's.
Signed for $30 million for 3 years. And kind of a confusing move to me on the surface just due to the fact that I didn't know if the A's were going to be in rebuild mode and kind of sell their young chips or if they were going to now try to build for one more year and kind of see if they have another run in them. But the A's, $30 million is a lot to the A's. So giving that to, I mean, Billy Butler had a down year, but a very good DH.
Definitely could
play a little first base. So. Still kind of confused as to which way the A's go, but it's nice to see them attacking early on in free agency and bringing in a well-known MLB player.
Yeah, that's true, bringing in a good, well-known player. But I think they kind of avoided their needs at this position. I think they needed a shortstop. I think that's the number one key thing that I think they should be looking for. I mean, also looking for an outfielder.
Yeah, I'm not going to disagree with that. The A's definitely need both middle infield positions, but shortstop more drastically because Jed Lowry is going to be too much, I think, on the free agent market for the A's. And then when you look at the replacement options, not too much is there. You can go as Drubal Cabrera, you can go Steven Drew, those kind of guys, but nothing really on the open market that says kind of we're going to drop a lot of money for you. So, I mean, seeing the A's spend $30 million on Billy Butler kind of and still disregarding the fact that they need a middle infielder.
Well, you know what that tells me? That tells me one thing. That tells me they have somebody coming up through the farm system.
They do. They have Daniel Robertson, who's in the right now single A, but he played extremely well in single A, and he looks like he's going to move up double A, triple A this next year. But I think he's still 1 year away from bringing up to where they need him to be major league ready.
Shortstops and second basemen, it's amazing where you can find them. I mean, you look at Panic and Crawford. I mean, Panic was brought up from Double A earlier in this year. I mean, he was our seventh second baseman of the year. I mean, thank God he panned out the way he is. And then where do we get Crawford? 1 year we don't have a second shortstop, and we bring in a Double A guy, bring him into training camp, and boom, he's our starting shortstop. Yeah. I mean, it's just middle infielders can be found because middle infielders don't have to be great hitters. They definitely have to be contact hitters, but they have to be great fielders.
Yeah, and see, the A's haven't had that much luck. As we're looking at the opposite side with them, they've had guys like Sogard, Kiaspo, Perino, guys who really don't hit and can't play great defense as well.
I mean, that's not a good
combination. We saw with Panic and Crawford in the World Series what kind of defense they possess, and the play that Panic made on that double play really saved, I think, the series.
The World Series.
Exactly, and that's not an understatement. It really did.
Absolutely not.
So, you see what kind of impact defense can have for your team in the biggest of stages, but yet I think the A's have kind of ignored that fact and they've kind of tried to find offense in the middle infield. But like you said, you don't need offense from those two positions.
Contact.
You need guys, who could put the ball in play, hit and run, maybe steal a little bases, but you need guys first off who could play defense and can pick it with the best of them.
Yeah, because that's where most of the balls come up, through the middle, to the sides, you know, filling those holes, being those definitely defensive players up the middle, and then you spread the offense around. You get offense in outfield. You get offense at first base. Definitely less skilled positions.
Yeah, that don't require you to be great with the glove.
Yeah, because glove is just center field. You need to be a solid. I think you have Coco Crisp. I think he's definitely a solid defensive player.
Still got Josh Reddick too. Who's Josh Reddick, one of the best right fielders.
Yeah. Oh, so Josh is great.
Defense isn't the problem in the outfield. It's just the infield, and we saw it in the wild card game. The defense cost them both at the catcher's position and up the middle, which is pretty much your three most important spots if you're going to think defensive. You want to be good at catcher and you want to be good up the middle on defense.
Yes,
and they had a horrible game. Really a mirror image of the season, because I predicted that the A's were not going to go far due to their bad defense up the middle. And that hurt them. So you got to kind of improve on that. So we'll see what kind of direction they go. But a nice start early on to the hot stove season, getting Butler for just $30
million. Yeah. Is John Lester gone?
John Lester's definitely gone. I don't know to who, though. There's going to be plenty of suitors for him.
He got a deal from the Red Sox. He turned it down.
Did he really?
It was like 4 years, $70 million or something like that.
He knows that he can get super bank wherever he wants to go. And it looks like the Blue Jays are going to be spenders this offseason, just like they were last year. But we'll see if they can improve.
I love when the Blue Jays spend. It makes the whole league pay way too much for everyone else.
And they have a bunch of has-been big names on their roster, but guys just can't produce enough to get them into the playoffs. And I thought this year might be the time, and they were kind of in first in that East division down the stretch, but with 2 months to go, they kind of struggled, limped in, got hurt, got injuries, and they really struggled down the stretch. So the Blue Jays are going to keep spending money, and we'll see if they can compete anymore at a higher level.
It really ruins – I mean, it's great for us because you know who else is a spender? The Dodgers. Everyone doesn't like the Dodgers. They're going to be spending the top dollar this year. They're going to pull out probably the John Lester. They might get the John Lester PV package that people are talking about.
If they got that, come on now. Oh. I mean, you go Kershaw, Greinke, Lester, PV. Oh, my gosh. And then you can throw in Heron or whoever else you want to throw. It doesn't really matter who the fifth pitcher is. That would be – and they have the money to do that. That's the saddest thing. How is that equal in sports to have the money to where one team can do that and kind of the other teams have to just watch and say, oh, I wish we had money.
The A's. It's just exactly. Yin and yang.
The A's, the Rays. Different. Guys, I mean, just teams that are good with what they have. But imagine if you had that much money to spend to where you can line up whoever you wanted in the free agent market and just be like, oh, we're going to get them because we have the most money.
Definitely. But you see in this post-steroid era, it's now a team game. It's no longer the individual, I'll hit the home runs to win us the game. It is the team game. It's the pitching. It's the defense behind you. And that's what I think these large market big teams like the Yankees and the Dodgers really overlook. They overlook the bullpen. They overlook defense because those are two that win the championship. What did the Dodgers not have last year? They did not have a bullpen. They have seven old closers from around the league that are all in their 30s.
And I don't see how they think that's going to work.
That does not work. And those guys used to throw 100. Now they throw in the low 90s.
And they've done that the last 2 years, too. They haven't really noticed that it's not working. They might as well go for a change.
And they give them ridiculous contracts. I'll bring this out because everyone doesn't like Brian Wilson anymore because he left us to go to the Dodgers and then yelled at our beloved Sabian to give him his ring in time. Do you everyone remember that?
Yeah.
When he was playing at the Dodger Stadium. He now has an option. He has a player option this year of a $10.5 million contract, which of course he took because he'd probably get veterans minimum, which is like $2.5 million from some other team that's not in contention and not in LA, but they gave him a 2-year contract with a player option at the end of the third year. That's unbelievable. $35 million to Brian Wilson. I mean, now they just throw around money like it's nothing. They really just throw out these crazy, crazy numbers, and then it really inflates the whole system, whole free agent market, and it sucks for teams like the A's or the Rays where they can't afford these mid tier players because they're so expensive.
Yeah. And we'll see if things change with the Dodgers, too, because they got the new GM now with Farhan Zaidi, or however you say his last name, the guy who comes over for the Oakland A's. So more of an analytics guy who might really try to work on that bullpen because I think he knows that's an important part.
He came out and said we want to copy exactly what the Giants have been doing, which I hate to hear.
Exactly. You don't want to hear that. If you're a Giants fan, you kind of wanted to hope that they keep things the same and just think that the money will...
Keep Ned Coletti up there. Keep Mattingly managing, which I love that they didn't fire him because this guy will just manage them into mistakes. He's just not a game-changing manager, which... we see in Bruce Bochy is super important. And
so
super.
I expect things to change from the Dodgers, but they're still going to spend that money to where they're going to get all the players they want just because they have the biggest and deepest pockets. They're kind of like the Yankees of 5-6 years ago, to where whoever wants to come will come just because of the money factor.
No, I agree. We are going to take another break, and then when we come back, we're going to finish up on some football talk. Everybody's dying about what's going to happen this weekend. Are the Raiders going to get their first win? Short week against KC, who they play very well each year. And will the Niners crush RG3 and show them who we are? So when we come back, well, that's what we'll be talking about.
What's the matter, Mary Jane? Had a hard day as he placed the don't disturb sign on the door. You lost your place in line again. What a pity. You never seem to want to dance anymore. The light. Censor your tears.
And we're back. Welcome. And we're going to talk a little Oakland Raiders football. This week they are going to be playing tomorrow night at 5:25 in the Oakland.co Coliseum. They will be playing the Kansas City Chiefs. Alex Smith led. Not Dexter McCluster. He's gone. He's on the Titans.
Jamal Charles. That's going to be the offense. Yes. Jamal Charles.
Yes. What did he rush last week? Some crazy numbers.
120-something with two TDs.
Yeah.
He got the two TDs in the first half, and they were able to beat the Seahawks. Kind of a huge win for them as they've won five games in a row.
Yeah.
7 out of 8. Their last loss coming to, like you said, the San Francisco 49ers.
Yes, that's correct.
But the one thing I think on the Raiders side is, this could be a trap game for the Chiefs. It's a Thursday night game, which is always tough on the visiting team because they got to travel on a short week. It's a divisional rivalry game, so that automatically adds a little bit more. And then the third thing is they got the Broncos next week, who is they're tied with atop the AFC West. They just played the Seahawks, so you're going from two of the Super Bowl champs there. I mean, two of the Super Bowl teams back-to-back weeks with the Raiders smushed in between. I think there's a chance for a letdown. What's your opinion on that?
Oh, absolutely letdown. You know, you'll overlook the short week. They're looking on. We got the Denver Broncos. We're just going to steam over this winless Raiders team. Without a doubt. And they have to come all the way to Oakland on a Thursday. Oy, yi, yi.
And you know the crowd's going to be rocking, too.
Oh, of course.
Because even though the Raiders haven't won a game, they're still selling out and they're still producing a good home field advantage to kind of pump up these teams. And you said, it's a divisional game.
Divisional games are a whole nother beast.
No matter how bad your team is, you always want to beat your in-division rival.
It doesn't matter. Those are the seasons right there. The reason why divisional games are the most tough and hard-fought games is because these teams face each other twice a year, every single year, without a doubt. They face each other, and you know these players. You hit them. You know which ones you go after. You played against them. You know their tendencies. It's like a rivalry. It's a built-in rivalry, and you compete with each other for the division. And these games are so much more important because the division counts. Division games counted. So that's a tiebreaker, and that's such an important aspect. So it's really important for Oakland to come out and just be fired up because this game is, I think, wide open.
Yeah, and I think adding more to the fire kind of per se, the Raiders haven't won a game, so they're just looking for some momentum or something to kind of hang their hat on. And the Chiefs, if you're playing against the Chiefs, they're tied for first in the AFC West. You can kind of derail their season a little bit here with the victory. And, you know, there's nothing more that you want to do against your rival than derail their season.
Yeah, definitely.
Especially in your hometown, in front of your fans where you haven't won a game all season. There's going to be some fight, and the way that this team, the Raiders that I'm speaking of, have kind of played over the last couple of weeks, this defense is still giving 100% effort, and they're trying their best to win games.
Charles Woodson, the old man, playing like he's 25 again, just flying around the field, being a general.
He leads the team in tackles. He's pretty much a ball hawk. He's everywhere anywhere can be, pretty much. So, I mean, the defense is giving it their all, and they're really playing extremely well on both sides. I mean, defense per se, but then you got Seal Moore, guys like that, Khalil Mack. The defense is doing it all, but it's really been the offense the last couple of weeks that hasn't really come to play. And when you're going 3 and out every time on the field as an offense, you're not giving your defense enough rest or chance to really compete and keep you in the game.
No, I agree. I think Mel Kiper came out a couple weeks ago and said that the Raiders have the number one draft class, and you just see it. Their defense is full of these great defensive rookies, and then you got David Carr. I always get Derek and David. You know, back he was the Derek was a first round pick overall for the Houston Texans when they were invented, when they begun. It's become a defensive team. I mean, this is a great start from a team. And when your team is defensive, that's the most important thing. You can build offense. You can win lots of games with your defense. I mean, the Niners showed it 3 years ago when we had Alex Smith as a quarterback. We were not a great offensive team. We knew our strengths. And that's what the Oakland Raiders need to develop. What is their strength? What do they want to become in the future? Do they want to become behind Derek Carr? Do they want to draft a running back in the upcoming draft and really become a run-first team? So it's a decision because you can ride this defense. Defense wins championships, as we've seen in Seattle, who really has a weak offense other than their running game.
Yeah, the Raiders have got to find an identity. And right now, their play calling and their formations and everything on the offensive side suggests that they don't have any clue to what kind of identity they want to be. They're 32nd in the league, which is last in rushing, in a historically low effort, 63 yards per game on the ground. And when you have a rookie quarterback in Carr, you can't be last in the league in rushing and expect any kind of output.
It's just unfair to him, because then you get put the pressure on, oh, he's a bust. He's a second round pick and he's a bust because he has not completing 60% of the passes. He's not throwing all these touchdowns. He's throwing his picks. Well, yes, that's what's going to happen when you have no running game. They're going to put back 7-8 back into drop into zone. Let him show him all these different disguise coverages.
And how hard is it for a rookie to pick apart that kind of coverage when there's no weapons on the outside
Absolutely.
As well? So it's really been a recipe for disaster and a recipe for 0-11. Like the Raiders are pretty much showing that they are that kind of team, and you are what your record says. And if the Raiders can't win a game coming up, I mean, I only see maybe two more chances after this one with St. Louis, but they've beaten the big dogs.
Yeah.
And then you got Buffalo.
Well, St. Louis, you can win because St. Louis plays to their opponent's level.
That's true. I've also heard that, but they they look extremely
terrifying.
Yeah, exactly. And then you got Buffalo late in the season as your last home game, but it's running out of time here for the Raiders, and they need to develop an identity to where you're either a run-first team and you kind of get something going, which is we haven't seen, so I don't know why that would start all of a sudden. But, I mean, you did get a little bit of a splash of that with Latavius Murray.
Yes, he's going to be getting the majority of the carries this week, I heard.
I hope so.
And that I was listening to them talk on NFL Network today. Their running back, he's got the speed. I mean, that's what they've been missing. I mean, you can't develop a run game with two running backs past their prime. And I really thought if Maurice Jones-Drew came there, I think that one of them, I don't think both of them can play. I don't think McFadden and Jones-Drew can play on the same team, because it's just such a majority of the carry, because you get a flow with the game. You don't get a flow when you get changed in so often. There's a difference between like a tandem running back where they come in like in and out. But the difference between like a Carlos Hyde and a Frank Gore takes the majority of the carries, and you have, when he's tired, you have him fill in. And you don't really have that in between those two. You have, you know, both guys who used to be number ones who still want to be number ones. And then you have this young guy coming out who I think is going to be a number one, because the NFL no longer has dominant running backs.
Yeah.
There is no more dominant running backs. It is who's doing it for me now league, and you see that with the New England Patriots. You see that with the Bengals. Who comes in now? Jeremy Hill. It's just unbelievable. Running back position has become one of the most, you know, unexpected. You know, you don't know who's going to be what in that week. You know, you can have DeMarco Murray just absolutely crush the first half of the season, and you know what? He might be down this half of the season. Or you have Giovanni Bernard, who did absolutely nothing in the first half of the season and definitely can crush in the second half.
Yeah. And running back's kind of a mystery, and that's why they're falling so much in the drafts now the last couple of years.
You don't know.
As teams kind of realize that, and they're not willing to take that risk on whether or not that running back could contribute. And like you said, you mentioned the Patriots, you mentioned the Bengals. A lot of the teams now are going to the multiple back sets, to where you don't have to give a guy 30 to 35 carries like you were maybe 3 or 4 years ago.
Yeah, those are like the passing teams of you know, moving the pocket, moving the defenses around with these speed running backs, you know, like the C.J. Spillmans, you know, the Giovanni Bernards are able to get out of the backfield. I mean, the Shady McCoy, I mean, that was the running back in the 2 years. That's what you wanted, the fast, quick back. But now you see a shift. I mean, again, defenses adapt. And those running backs that are shifty and quick are not the ones that are doing the best this year. You see the big backs. You see, like, the Arian Foster, who's just hitting those holes hard. You see the Le'Veon Bell, man. He doesn't make any excess movement. He just cuts up the middle. I think 90% of his runs are between the tackles. And then you have the Shady McCoy, where now they're trying to get to outside, and now these defenders know the read option. If that quarterback keeps the ball, just get him and play out wide, because they always are trying to bounce it out. And I think that's what an issue with the whole league and the running back. I mean, Gray for the New England, now all he does is just hit the hole where they tell him to run it. That's where he goes. So that's the difference between the quick running back and then the. And then it's like the Chris Johnsons too. It's like you lose one step, you don't have anything anymore.
Exactly.
You lose a half a step.
Exactly. Yeah.
So it's that is the Raiders right now. They will hopefully find an identity this week against KC. Hope it's on the
some
arm.
Some kind of identity.
I hope it's on the arm of Carr. And I really am pulling for him because I like his brother. I like him. He went to Fresno State, like his brother. And I just love the way he plays. I think he's got great mechanics. I mean, obviously his mechanics are not going to look good in the first couple games because he's, I mean, he's now in an NFL pass rush.
it's a
whole new game. It's men rushing after you. It's no longer boys and kids. It's men. So let's hope the Raiders get a win this week and show who they are. And that is all for this week on Banter by the Bay. Thank you, Temple, for being here and joining me. It was fun bantering
around.
Great
sports talk with you.
Yes, it is great sports talk. We will be back in 2 weeks. It'll be my last episode, but I hope you all listen. Thank you so much, and I'll see you in 2 weeks.